Welcome to Applied. I'm Baron Gogan. I'm here today with Jordan Suter, Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at CSU. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Baron. This is great.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, well, I am a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics at CSU. I also chair our graduate program within the department. Before coming to CSU, I got an undergraduate degree at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. And then I went up to Ithaca, New York, and got my master's and PhD in resource economics at Cornell University, which is a bit closer to my hometown of Rochester, New York, where I grew up. After completing my PhD, I was a professor at Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio, for about 6 years, and then was fortunate enough to come out here to Colorado State and join the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics. You know, my research largely focuses on the intersection between land use outcomes and water resource management. You can imagine that those two are closely linked. And I work on issues that kind of cover the breadth of water scarcity issues, as well as water quality issues, even into issues related to flooding and municipal water resource management.
Living in Colorado, a lot of folks are familiar with water and sort of some of the issues and complexities around that. So it's definitely a big topic. Before we jump into the water, though, could you explain kind of what natural resource economics is? That's a subfield of economics then?
Yeah, that's right. I think people, when they hear the word economics, they ultimately think about money and banking and inflation, those kinds of issues. But at its core, economics is a study of how societies choose to allocate scarce resources. So within that paradigm, you can imagine that natural resource economics really focuses on how we can manage those limited natural resources that we have in a way that provides as much as possible, as many benefits as possible for society over the long term. It has its roots really in land economics, which was one of the original areas of study for some of the classical economists like Thomas Malthus or Ricardo Adam Smith, all thought about the way that land integrated into the economy and represented an important source of wealth in the economy. Now, as we know it today, natural resource economics largely built out of the environmental movement of the 1960s and 70s as we were thinking about air quality and water quality, and economists became interested in thinking about how we benefit from those attributes and how we can incorporate that into the decision-making around the regulations that were coming in at the time, thinking about benefits and costs of those policies and really how to optimize them to provide environmental quality at a reasonable cost to households and understanding the benefits that those policies provide to households. And so, you know, natural resource economists today focus on issues ranging from the management of scarce fisheries, water resources, timber, into thinking about the management of climate and climate policies related to greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera.
So then I imagine some areas that would be related and would be like, you know, working for the EPA perhaps, or regulatory organizations maybe?
Sure. You know, the regulatory agencies certainly have a lot of economists on staff, but so too do agencies like the Bureau of Reclamation focuses a bit more on water resources. Also thinking about right here in town, we have the Rocky Mountain Research Station of the United States Forest Service, who has a team of great economists who are doing work related to wildfire issues in addition to water resource management and open space management.
And so then I imagine you work with policymakers as well then?
Yeah, I think that we work with stakeholders at the various agencies, whether they be at the USDA or Department of Interior. And we're also working with more local stakeholders here in the state of Colorado and folks with the Department of Water Resources.
This has been a subfield since maybe like the 70s when the EPA and some of those regulations started to come about for the first time and people started to really keeping track of these things more seriously.
I think you're right. I think that the subfield of environmental economics and natural resource economics really blossomed in the 1970s and 80s. So it's a relatively new subfield within the discipline, even though you can trace some of the roots back well into the, you know, 18th century.
Because, yeah, the environmental movement, even though it was pretty nascent at that time, was still I mean, it was slowly gaining traction. People were getting more interested in, I think Silent Spring came out in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And then people just became more aware of what was happening in the environment.
Yeah, I think there was a sense that there wasn't unlimited sets of resources to continue to go after, and that we had to do a better job with respect to stewardship of the resources that we do have, and thinking about sustainability and how we maintain this economy and the economic benefits that we derive from natural resources.
Can you explain a little bit about why water is just so complex in Colorado and the Western U.S. in general?
That's a big question. The simple answer is scarcity, right? If Colorado was a humid state with plenty of precipitation and water resources, we probably wouldn't be having this discussion. But the simple answer is scarcity and demand for water with respect to the fact that water is used in the production process and by households to generate huge benefits. And coupled with the scarcity is the fact that it's very uncertain, right? We don't know exactly how much water is going to fall on a given day and a given month. And it's highly variable over the course of the year. So we'll have some parts of the year where we have too much water and flooding, have other parts of the year where, you know, we have a water scarcity and drought, and folks are really trying to prioritize that water use and thinking about competition for water resources. And so I think that there's obviously a lot of conflict around water, and that's not something new here in the state of Colorado. But as populations continue to grow and as climate patterns change, you know, I think those problems are becoming more and more challenging.
Right. And not all of the water that's in Colorado belongs to Coloradans, right?
Absolutely. You know, Colorado is a headwater state, and that means that, you know, a lot of rivers originate here within the state, the Colorado River, obviously, being the most noteworthy. But we have compacts with other states that say, hey, we have to deliver a certain amount of surface water. We can't use all of that water that falls as precipitation within the state. And that means that, you know, although water is the kind of hydrologic properties of water are highly predictable, and water stays within watersheds and within aquifers, ultimately those watersheds and aquifers don't coincide with the political boundaries that we have, whether those are county boundaries or state boundaries. And that really does make the management more difficult and make some of the rulemaking, which ultimately is at the state level for the most part with respect to water resources, challenging when those resources flow from Colorado into other states.
And so these compacts and arrangements have existed for decades and maybe longer?
Yeah, I think that if you look at each of the major river systems within Colorado, the compacts all originated at slightly different times. But yes, they tend to be 100 years old, I would say, on average. And sometimes, you know, those compacts were arranged at a time when population and water use was very different. And maybe even precipitation patterns were very different than they are today.
Yeah, Colorado has grown significantly in the last century, for sure.
Absolutely. And Colorado is not alone, obviously. Many Western states have seen large population growth and changes in, you know, in industry and agriculture, et cetera.
So some of that difficulty then is probably related to the fact that laws are difficult to change, and there's a lot of stakeholders involved across state lines, and the population continues to change. There's also a very ongoing drought. Is that correct?
Well, I think that drought is something that has become more frequent and more severe over the last decades. And coupled that with increasing populations and populations, particularly in urban areas, whereas water resources, historically, the water rights are held in more rural agricultural areas. And so that has kind of set up a conflict. As cities grow and acquire more water rights, those water rights often come from agricultural areas, and that presents challenges to those areas as the water rights maybe leave the rural communities and flow towards the urban areas.
So how does economics then come into play when we're talking about water management and policy in Colorado? And I imagine that's a very important part of it to understand the data, essentially.
Yeah, I think that if you think about, we have scarce water resources, the kind of key economic question is, how do we allocate those scarce resources across users? And those users are quite different, right? Between agricultural water use, commercial and industrial water use, municipal water use, and then in-stream flows, right? We want to keep some water in the stream because that also generates economic benefits from recreation activities and from ecosystem services, biodiversity, et cetera. And so those are challenging questions that we have to address. And oftentimes what leads to the water use that we observe is the historic water rights that persist. And one of the things that economists often study are markets, and markets for water within the state of Colorado are quite interesting. You know, there's important benefits that can be gained by trading water rights from lower value uses to higher value uses. And so there's certain economic benefits from vibrant water markets, but
could you explain lower value versus higher value?
Well, if you think about, you know, the use of water for a relatively low value crop, let's say, and in a high elevation area that maybe is fairly low profits to the producer, it may be that they could exchange those water rights with another producer who's able to generate much higher benefits, growing a higher value crop. And in so doing, right, in a market, both individuals can benefit because it's a voluntary exchange. And so to the extent that we can have those voluntary exchanges occur such that we're able to get more benefits out of the limited water resources that we have, that can be a great outcome. At the same time, there can be some what economists would call external costs associated with a transaction, wherein folks that aren't involved in that transaction can feel some costs. So if I'm a water rights holder and the water rights get traded in a way that limits the amount of water I'm able to access in the future, then that infringes on my rights. Or if it changes the quality of the water that I receive, then that can negatively impact other water rights holders. And so some of those costs are important to understand as we think about kind of implementing or advocating for more market trades. It can also be that a lot of the transactions that do occur are water moving from agricultural areas into urban regions. And although the individuals that sell those water rights are doing so voluntarily, there may be some kind of community level negative effects as lots of the water moves away from the community, and that means less profitable production, and that can have some kind of trickle down effects on other folks within the region, and ultimately, you know, affect the viability of those agricultural communities. And so that's certainly an issue that economists have focused on, and understanding some of those more community level effects of water transactions.
So that makes sense. So to kind of summarize what you're saying there, if I understand this correctly, there are some more rural towns in Colorado, for example, maybe Eastern Colorado, that are very agricultural focused, or the community is kind of built around a lot of agriculture. And then over time, more farmers just get out of the business, sell their water rights, retire. Maybe the next generation doesn't pick that up. And so the farms, you know, start to close and the water rights go. And then that local economy is impacted.
That's right. Yeah. So these kind of these community-wide effects, as you think about, you know, the tax base leaving an area as lots of water is sold, and that irrigated agriculture, you know, is really an economic engine in the rural community. As that engine departs, it has kind of more systemic effects on the whole community, population, et cetera. And so, you know, thinking about ways that we can better understand the trade-offs and ways that we can still have some water that moves from agricultural entities to urban areas where a lot of the demand is, but doing so in a way that doesn't have as negative an impact on those local communities. And I think also just to get back to your question about kind of what role does economics play in water policy, I think that when you take a principles of economics course, one of the things you learn is that incentives matter and people respond to incentives. And to the extent that we can engage in conservation in municipal areas and use less water, that means we don't need as many of these transactions from agricultural to urban areas. And I think that economists have a toolbox of incentives that can help to think about what those conservation practices might be at the household level that reduce water use and ultimately, as populations grow, mean that we don't need as much water moving to urban regions. And so water is a basic human need, obviously. So we don't want to price people out of a market for water resources. But at the same time, most of the water that we use is a luxury. Right. Most of the water
green
we
grass,
use.
Green grass, lawns, and golf courses and things like that.
Yep. It goes right onto the landscape, or it goes into, you know, washing our vehicles, et cetera. And so to the extent that we can price water in a way that illustrates how critical a resource it is, makes people think a little bit more about the water that they're using, particularly this water for more of the luxury type uses of watering landscapes, et cetera.
Right. So essentially, if we can all be a little more efficient, have a little more sustainable system with the water, get more out of the water that we have not waste as much water, then that will impact those rural communities less, would you say?
I think that's true. It's probably overly simplistic to say that will solve all the issues, right?
Sure.
I think that we need to have kind of an all of the above type approach. When you think about water scarcity in urban areas, probably need to think about how we increase the supply of water resources, whether that's through more storage or more water rights being owned by municipal users. But, you know, I think the demand side is also critical. And if to the extent that we can really reduce overall demand, that's going to limit the amount that we need to, you know, think about supply side changes.
Right.
Now, when you have population growing as fast as it is, it's difficult to imagine actually reducing overall demand for water resources in municipal regions. But at the same time, to the extent that we can engage in more efficient and conserve more municipal water resources on a household level, that means that, you know, we don't need to reallocate as much water.
Right. I imagine it's not just up to urban areas and households as well as it's, you know, agricultural operations can be more efficient as well with their water use, having more modern systems to irrigate and things like that.
And that has happened in many areas. I think if you look at water use overall, it's been a success story, both at the municipal level and at the agricultural level. We're doing more with less, and that's a victory. At the same time, there can be unintended consequences associated with that. For example, when you irrigate more efficiently, it means that less water ends up going back into the stream that comes from the irrigation sources, and that can mean changes for folks downstream. So water's a complex issue, and some of those external impacts that I talked about earlier can happen when you have efficiency improvements that ultimately alter hydrologic outcomes downstream. So not to say that we shouldn't be doing those things, but sometimes, you know, efficiency enhancements can mean that we end up irrigating more acreage and having fewer return flows, and sometimes that can represent a challenge.
It's not just about the water that we see above ground, there's a significant amount underground, right?
There's a significant amount underground, and it's increasingly important as you think about the variability of surface water flows. You know, groundwater has a real benefit that it doesn't vary in unpredictable ways over time. But unfortunately, there is a kind of limited stock that we have available, and as we're using more than is being replenished, that stock is declining over time.
For folks listening, one example of that would be the aquifers that are tapped for water in places like Colorado Springs and, is, I believe, Denver as well.
Mm-hmm. There are a number of communities across the Front Range that rely on groundwater resources, and obviously agricultural enterprises that use groundwater fairly significantly in the eastern portion of the state.
Could you tell us a little bit about the history behind the Republican River Compact? So that's one example of an ongoing issue that is kind of being worked through, hasn't been finalized yet.
Right. The Republican River Basin is one that many folks on the Front Range might not know about, because it is a basin that actually starts east of I-25. And what that means is that it doesn't benefit from a snowfall in the mountains. So all of the surface water that exists in that basin comes from precipitation that happens in the eastern portion of the state. In the early 1940s, Colorado, Nebraska, and Kansas signed the Republican River Compact that required Colorado to deliver a certain amount of surface water in the North Fork of the Republican, the Arickaree River, and the South Fork of the Republican River to the states of Nebraska and Kansas. Now, Colorado has very limited surface water use of those rivers, but all three states began developing groundwater after World War II in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. There was a large increase in kind of high volume irrigation happening in that region.
Wells, basically.
Yeah, wells being put in. And one of the unintended consequences of that was that it affected surface water flows in the Republican River as those groundwater tables began to decline. And so at some point in the late 1990s, there was a lawsuit between Kansas and Nebraska, where Kansas basically alleged that the groundwater use in Nebraska, as well as Colorado, was contributing to those states not meeting the terms of the Republican River Compact. And so that case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and a special master of the Supreme Court did determine that groundwater needed to be considered as part of the Republican River Compact, which was really written before groundwater was even really thought about in that area.
Right.
And so this generated a bit of a challenge because of all of the wells in Colorado that had gone in throughout the latter half of the 20th century. And as the states were trying to reach an agreement, there were some different strategies that Colorado was attempting to use to come in line with the compact. So one agreement that they reached was that Colorado would actually build a pipeline along the North Fork of the Republican River, wherein they pump water out of the ground from some high-producing wells that are well away from the river, and they pump that water directly into the river right across the border in Nebraska so that we meet the terms of the compact with Nebraska. That particular strategy is funded now through a tax on irrigated land, a fee on irrigated land that the producers in the Republican Basin have to pay. Mm. And so they're paying into this pipeline. And unfortunately, the pipeline alone doesn't completely allow Colorado to meet our terms of the agreement. So along the south branch of the Republican River, there was an agreement in 2016, that Colorado would retire 25,000 acres of land within the South Fork of the Republican River Basin. So as you can imagine, that's quite a bit of land to take out of production. And I think today we have about 10,000 of those 25,000 acres that have been taken out of production. Those are producers that have voluntarily agreed to receive a payment to stop irrigating land and take their wells out of the ground, essentially. Mm. Now, the challenge is that if we don't reach the 25,000 acres by the deadline of 2029, there is a threat from the state engineer's office that all the wells in the Republican Basin will have to be curtailed, will have to be shut off if we don't meet that 25,000 acre goal. And so that's a pretty draconian threat, and that's an existential threat to the local economies in that area.
Yeah.
Something that they're obviously very concerned about.
So how is that being managed currently? Is it basically voluntary right now?
That's right. So there is a compensation system that's set up so that producers that agree to take land that's currently irrigated out of irrigated production are paid on an annual basis, typically over a 15-year contract. And depending on the program that they join, they can engage in dry land crop production or grazing on that land. But obviously that's less profitable than using the land for irrigated agriculture.
Right. Are you optimistic that Colorado would be able to meet that obligation by the deadline? Or like, what is it looking like right now in terms of how that's progressing?
I guess I don't want to speculate too much, you know, on what's going to happen by 2029, but I would say that there's some catching up to do, that if we only have, you know, 10 or 12,000 acres retired, we're not yet halfway to the goal, and we don't have a whole lot of time to do that. You can imagine that the folks that participate first are probably the ones that have the lowest value associated with irrigation. And unfortunately, as your neighbors stop irrigating, that leaves more water for the folks that stay in, and having more water is profitable. So it becomes a bit harder and harder, I think, to get more and more land taken out of production in a voluntary way like that. So I think that there's going to be a big push to reach that goal, and certainly the intention is to reach the goal. But part of the work that we're doing now is to understand what would be the impacts if indeed curtailment across the Republican Basin, and there we're talking about, you know, 3,500 wells would be taken out of production. You know, what would that mean for the local economy? And then what would that mean on a larger kind of regional basis for the state of Colorado and even for the neighboring states of Kansas and Nebraska if all of that irrigated production were to go away?
So a lot of crops would not be produced subsequent years, and the local economies would be affected. So it would be like a big trickle down effect, to use a water analogy.
That's right. Yeah. We refer to those as kind of indirect impacts and induced impacts. As you know, the irrigated land goes away, first of all, we need to think about what is it going to be replaced by. Is all that land just going to be fallowed? That would be kind of a worst case scenario. Or are we at least able to do some dry land agricultural production on those acres that are no longer irrigated? Or is it used for grazing? And so that in part is going to determine the economic impact. But then, you know, those are kind of the direct impacts on the folks that own and operate that land. Then you have folks that are supplying the individuals that are doing that agricultural production, whether those are the seed producers or the crop consultants or, you know, the folks that are the engineers building the irrigation systems, et cetera. You know, those individuals in the agricultural supply industry would also be negatively affected. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, some of the effects just on the local economies where you have less spending. If agriculture is less profitable, we have less money to spend at the coffee shop, at the local retail establishments, et cetera. We also generate less tax revenue. And so, you know, some of the public services, the schools, et cetera, would also be impacted. And so I think some of the longer term impacts are very difficult to predict, what happens to population and so forth. But in the short run, trying to understand what some of these direct and indirect effects would be of such a wide scale curtailment of groundwater.
So in your research, could you maybe give a little bit of a summary of like, what's the best case scenario versus the worst case scenario, broadly speaking, if we didn't meet the deadline and they just had to turn it off?
Well, I think the best case scenario is that we are able to convert most of the land that's currently irrigated into profitable dry land agricultural production. But we know that's not going to be possible on all of the acreage. Simply the types of soils and the climate just don't support dry land agriculture in many areas. And so I think the kind of worst case scenario is that we see a lot of land fallowing, where producers, you know, don't even replant that acreage. And that can also be, you know, ecologically challenging as well. There was a reason that folks moved away from this area in the Dust Bowl, as it's hard to do agriculture in the region. And when we leave soils bare, things that, you know, we don't want to have happen again are possible.
Would What should more policymakers in Colorado understand about this issue?
I think the policymakers in Colorado are well versed in a lot of these challenges. I think that particularly as it pertains to agricultural water use, I don't think any agricultural producer wants a lot of top-down solutions. I think to the extent that policymakers can clearly define the rules and allow local areas to coordinate and think about the measures that make the most sense for those local areas, that can be highly beneficial. So, you know, one of the things that that is often clear is whether a producer that engages in water conservation will be able to maintain their full water right. That often is kind of prevents more conservation of water resources from occurring. So as part of the prior appropriation doctrine that governs water rights in Colorado, there's typically a rule that if you don't use it, you lose it. But that can impede conservation, right? So if a producer is trying to use less water to grow the same amount of crops, but then because they've used less water, it means they have less water right that they can sell in the future, that's value that's been lost to them. And so to the extent that those rules can be clearly articulated, and the rules that govern kind of the more regional management of water resources, there are groundwater management districts and water conservation districts out there. I think to the extent that they know what power they have to put in place rules and potentially to put in place, you know, different fee mechanisms, that can empower local areas to manage water resources in a way that makes sense for them, rather than having the state come in and tell them how to use their water. I'm confident nobody wants that. Right. And, you know, I also think that nobody likes uncertainty. Producers, households, developers, uncertainty can really limit what can be done. And so from the standpoint that policymakers can reduce that uncertainty about the rules that govern water use, I think that benefits everyone.
What should more Coloradans, especially those working in agriculture, understand about the situation with water?
I think oftentimes there's a sentiment that voluntary measures might be enough to engage to generate significant amounts of conservation. But when resources are shared, groundwater being a quintessential example, one person engaging in some conservation just leaves more water for others to use. And so on net, that kind of individual voluntary contribution of water conservation often doesn't amount to much. And so I think thinking of ways to engage in a more cooperative solutions that involve large numbers of producers is really the way to preserve and conserve water resources for future generations and for the communities that depend on that water. I think that some of the work that we've done has looked at more comprehensive conservation measures. Instead of paying producers to take individual wells out of production, compensating larger sets of producers that do small amounts of water conservation can be more economically viable and generate better water conservation outcomes, rather than just paying a few producers large amounts of money to fully take their wells out of production. Our research suggests that we'd be better off paying broader sets of users to engage in small amounts of water conservation, and that would be kind of more sustainable in the long term, both economically and with respect to water resource availability.
Yeah, it makes sense if you think about the math. Rather than having one person turn off their water completely, if you had 100 people reduced by 10 or 15%, that would add up to a lot more. That's kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's less, everybody has some skin in the game, so to speak, and you have less of these rebound effects where one person uses a lot less water, but that just means more water for the neighbors in the future, which is beneficial. But we'd rather see, you know, a more comprehensive conservation solution that leads to more water in the aquifer in the long run.
What should more Coloradans living in urban areas kind of know or understand about this, the water situation overall?
Well, I think that each individual, you know, urban water user, one thing that folks should know is that most water is used outdoors rather than indoors. And I think probably that's relatively well known. But if we really want to cut back on water use at the municipal level, it has to do more with the landscape and also with our urban policies more generally. I think where we've seen growth is largely kind of outside of the traditional urban boundaries of Fort Collins, Boulder, and Denver. It's in the smaller communities that have seen a lot of population growth. And that's where those are the communities that are scrambling to find more water resources and having to purchase water resources from agricultural entities, et cetera. If you look at overall water use in Denver or Fort Collins, for that matter, it's pretty flat over time. So even though populations have been rising, we've been able to meet that with increased efficiency and conservation at the municipal level. But where municipal water use is growing tends to be in the kind of smaller, what used to be rural communities and are now kind of more suburban communities. I think also just understanding that economics is a good tool for thinking about trade-offs. And when you look at what a progressive water utility like Fort Collins Utilities is doing, they have lots of programs for water conservation. They'll pay you to replace your shower head or your toilet. They'll pay you to take turf grass out and replace it with, you know, xeriscaping. They have information campaigns. They have, compare your water use to your neighbors, et cetera. And these are all interesting programs, but I think we can put more resources into thinking about what are the trade-offs in these. We're putting a lot of money into them. What are we getting out of them in terms of water conservation, so that maybe we can refocus those efforts on the programs that generate the most conservation per dollar that we put in?
Just being more efficient overall.
Well, I think being efficient overall, not just with the water, but the dollars that go into conserving that water.
Right. More strategic maybe is a better answer.
Yeah, I like that, strategic. I mean, if we can use the same budget to double the amount of water conservation, nobody's going to argue with that. And so that's the kind of thing that economists are pretty good at studying, what we get out of the limited budget that we put into these types of programs.
Right. Because it takes funding to create those programs and to keep them going, and then takes funds to do the research to understand if it's working, how to pivot strategy or reallocate things to be more efficient and strategic over time. But it seems like those investments are worthwhile in the long term.
I think many of them are. And I think to the extent that we can reallocate budget towards the programs that are the most effective, then that's going to generate, you know, greater conservation with those limited dollars that we have to generate these programs.
What would you say is one of the biggest challenges Colorado might face, you know, over the next decade or so?
I don't think there'll be lots of new challenges insofar as we've seen challenging changes in population and changes in climate as we see more variability in precipitation and drought, flooding, et cetera. I think that's going to continue. And I think population growth is going to continue. And so the challenges that we've observed recently are going to persist. And to the extent that we have solutions that help to manage those challenges, obviously, you know, those are things that we need to continue working on.
Right. Growth is going to continue. It's hard to blame people for wanting to come to Colorado. So it makes sense that Colorado needs to kind of accept that's kind of the way it's going to continue on and then just be more proactive.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of water that we have available is not changing. The variability, if anything, is increasing in when and where we're receiving precipitation, you know, temperatures affecting snowpack and so forth, which alter when rivers have water. And so all of those dynamics are difficult to manage alongside a growing population that needs that water for production and household uses.
And recreation.
And recreation, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's an issue that we see year to year, you know, just up at the reservoir. Depending on the season, it could be great or concerningly low.
Yeah, I mean, the water management is complex. and the reservoir systems are one buffer that we have against variable precipitation, right? To the extent that we can store water and use it when it's most valuable, that can generate huge benefits. But at the same time, it's costly to put in those reservoir systems, and it can affect surface water flows in ways that aren't advantageous to downstream users and ecosystems.
What makes you optimistic about the future?
I think there have been some real victories with respect to water conservation and water use efficiency. As we've talked about, agricultural water use is becoming and has grown more efficient over the last century, really. We're able to produce a lot more crops that, using limited water resources than we were. And similarly, at the municipal level, households are using significantly less water on a per capita basis than they used to. So I think, you know, let's not shy away from those victories. And ultimately, you know, necessity drives innovation, and necessity can drive cooperation as well. I've seen some really innovative practices and folks that are working to engage with their communities to make water use more sustainable in agricultural areas as well as in urban areas. And that's great to see. And I think we learn a lot from some of those activities. Lots of little experiments going on out there about how to conserve water resources. And to the extent that we can learn what's worked well and what hasn't, we can continue to make improvements in that area.
I agree. As a state and even as a region, we just need to maybe invest a little bit more into innovation and stop expecting the status quo to be the way it can stay, because it just can't.
That's right. Yeah, we're going to have to continue to innovate as demands on water resources grow and as the amount of water that we have becomes more variable and harder to predict.
Last question. If people want to learn more about natural resource economics or water policy, where should they go?
Well, I think there's a lot of resources at CSU and beyond. Obviously, the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics is a great place for students, and we have majors in environmental and resource economics. The Water Center at CSU is a great resource. They have a magazine, Colorado Water, which is accessible to everyone, and I think has some really exciting case studies and research that's going on at the university. The Colorado Water Conservation Board has done some excellent work and has a nice website highlighting some of the research and innovation that's going on in water policy across the state. There are some groups that have a more regional or national focus. Headwaters Economics is an interesting organization that does a little bit more on the land management side, but also looks at water resources in the West in particular. And then you have a national group like Resources for the Future that has been working on water resource economics and natural resource economics more generally for many years. They put out a magazine called Resources Magazine that I would recommend to audiences. West Water Research is an organization that has a presence here in Fort Collins, actually, and they do some interesting research related to water resource management and have some things online that are useful to readers of all interest levels.
Dr. Suter, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun, and I look forward to hearing these conversations going forward.